Behind, we're going to go ahead and call the high school redesign work group to order. Just a few announcements before we get started. As I mentioned, this is a work group, and so as a result, we are not keeping minutes, but the sessions are recorded. And so what that means, because it is, we are a little bit more of an informal group, we do not take action on anything.
We talk more.
Highly effective, aren't we? But we do, there's one other announcement before we get started, and that is I'd like to welcome Representative Detmer. He is here tonight on his, out of the goodness of his own will. And we want to make sure that he knows that he is invited to this work group committee anytime, and we would love to have him and his expertise as a part of this committee. When we first put this work group together, we wanted to make sure that we took into account what some of the things that were going on in schools already. And so we've made an attempt to listen to some schools who have engaged in some level of redesign. And tonight we did invite the Forest Lake superintendent, and he was not able to come for some reason. And so we will not be hearing from a school tonight, but I think that we still have quite a full agenda. But what that means is that we can take a few minutes to talk about some of the preliminary work that we've all done in order to assess what we are doing in our high schools now. And I did not prepare any of you for this, but I did it before we started. Is we've asked everybody in the group to go to 3 high school classes and sit in on them. And then what we ask them to do is to assess strengths and weaknesses of the experience. And so I'd like to just take 5 minutes tonight and go around the group and tell me a little bit about what do you think, as you observed the high school classroom, what did you see as strengths? And what did you see as weaknesses? And Representative Benson, would you like to start?
I would not, sure, but I haven't gone to those classes yet.
Don't you teach?
No, I do not, but I have.
I'm just kidding you. That's fine. That's fine.
I will.
Representative
Next
Brown.
I've had an opportunity to get into one higher level chemistry class. And of course, my observations, and I teach 3 different classes of art, photography, digital photography, and sculpture. So I've been watching how my students work as well. But I did get into another classroom, and I think one of the strengths that I noticed within this particular classroom was the teacher's ability to draw out very thoughtful answers because of the way she worded questions as she went through a review of an assignment they had done earlier in the week. So her questioning skills were amazing, and her ability to bring the students into the conversation, have them come up with the answers as opposed to her just speaking the answers to them. So I appreciated that, and that's something that I'm striving for in my own classroom. Other things that I have observed also that maybe are not so positive is that there is still a group of students who, and I am not talking about special needs students or special ed students, there's still a group of students that I'm noticing that that are trying to do the minimum with an expectation of a very high grade. And I think that there probably is something to be said for the conversation that we have about grade inflation. Students are expecting, a C from 15 years ago that was perfectly acceptable and average work is now thought of as much differently. It's almost like students are truly expecting A's and B's by doing average work, at least not in this particular high-level class, but in some of the average classes I've observed that the everyday student's going to. And that bothers me. And I don't know if it's because I don't know why it is. I don't know if we're expecting less or if we're trying to accommodate parents who want that A for college entrance purposes. I don't know what the answer to that is, but I see the students expecting higher grades for less work.
Interesting. Representative Swales.
This has been a full day of educational things for me. After completing a full day of teaching, I'm a team leader for my 10th grade English team at the high school, and so I went through that, and I had the opportunity to observe two classes last week taught by new teachers, and I right after my 10th grade team meeting today, I had to go to part of our QCOMP program is peer coaching, and so I just came from a peer coaching training to kind of solidify what we're supposed to do with our mentees. But it was very interesting observing those two teachers in those two courses. One of them was for students who are at risk, and the class is taught in skinnies. We're in a 4-period day, so a skinny is, you know, half the period is one group, and it alternates with a social studies group, and they flip-flop into that class. And it was interesting to me. One of the good things about it is they're able to keep the class sizes small. They are under 20. The students, this is high school, but these are skinny. So within that same class, they really were working with 40 students. But I guess it's more bang for the buck kind of teaching, but the teacher will have these students all year long instead of for the two terms, which would be a full year of teaching. And it was interesting to me that, once again, it's a brand new teacher that is put into the classroom with these at-risk kids. Mm-hmm. And that for me is a comment on where sometimes our priorities are. I mean, I'm very happy to be teaching all advanced classes, and I'm glad I'm at the point in my career that is respected. But I also see that sometimes we really do need the skilled, experienced teacher in the classroom with these at-risk kids. Even though this teacher did a beautiful job, there were some classroom management things that I observed that when I talked with her, just, right after our team meeting today, that we were able to address and talk about. But I think that is kind of a failure that I see across the board, and in looking at other school districts and knowing that this is a problem that goes on. We continue to put some of the least trained people in with the students with the highest needs, and I'm hoping that we can address that. The other class that I observed was speech class, and of course this was a seasoned teacher in this classroom with very animated lessons, and students were engaged, and there was a lot of humor and a lot of laughter, and it was just a wonderful class to be in. But two very different experiences.
Thank you. Representative Dempmer.
I know I haven't been part of this working group, but
I think you can handle this question.
Recently retired teacher, after 34 years, I decided to continue in the role of a substitute teacher. So I've had several calls already just in the last few weeks. I've been able to schedule two of them. One was an elementary K through 5 physical education. My hat's off to the elementary teachers. I was totally worn out after the day in the physical education. Although the teacher, full-time teacher, had something very well planned out, and it went very smoothly. But I think if you ever do some substitute teaching, I would suggest that you go into maybe a department that you're not really certified in and see what other departments are like. Last week I substituted in the industrial arts department, in the drafting and small engine department. And this teacher, which I didn't know very well, this is at the high school, apparently a new teacher. He had everything well planned out. I came in, and I could sit down and administer the assignments and the tests and so forth. And I gained a lot of appreciation for another department besides the physical education area. So I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Tilbury.
Yes, Madam Chair. I was able to visit some classrooms, and of course it's pretty easy for me to be able to do that, being that I'm a counselor in the high school.
But so you went to more than three.
Yeah, probably. But the three that I'm going to mention, for a math class and a health class and then also an interpersonal communications class. And the thing that I noticed about these particular classes in the different parts of the building was I saw great teaching happening. I saw them connecting with students. Some had difficult subject matter. Of course, when I look at the math class, I think of anything in math as difficult when I look at it. But these kids were learning these equations and so on and what they needed to look forward to. And I was impressed with that. And I always seem to be impressed with the teacher as they go through that. But I looked around the classroom, and then I saw all types of different students. We saw students that couldn't speak English, like an ELL student that I knew from registering the student that student's going to be lucky to understand a word that's being said. To special ed students that have great difficulty either processing notes or processing auditory type things. It just depends. They're all different cases. Then I also saw students that were high ability, that were just excelling beyond and interested in the conversation and things that were happening. But I did see this other student that's somewhere in the middle. And I saw one of them, and I guess I have a benefit because a lot of these students, I can see what their picture is outside the classroom. I can look at transcripts, I can see their grades overall and so on. And I watched one student that just sat and didn't even move his notebook. And, you know, took the passive route of, when is this over? And I want to move to my next spot. And that's the one that I'm most worried about, is that middle student. Because I know that there's services that are provided kind of on both ends, but what about that middle? And sometimes it's because the student, I think, is comfortable with that or gave up or whatever, but kind of floating in and out. But then at other times, I think they gave up because maybe they weren't getting any type of attention with whatever their needs were. The one disturbing thing that I saw, too, was the negative side of things. When I went into the interpersonal communications class, it was at 38 students. And I know, and of course, I have to take hand into putting some of those students in there, so it's what we had to do. But I walked into the classroom, there's no place to go. There's desks everywhere. She had to have a path to the front of the class, or she could arrange desks any which way she could. I couldn't even walk around. There was one path to get towards the board, and that's all she could do. And I thought, 38 students, that scenario just doesn't work. And yet, we've been tossing around ideas on how to solve it, but just the way things have worked out, it's just not working for that scenario.
Thank you. Representative Benson, did that elicit any thoughts for you? Any memories of the classroom?
Well, thank you. All of these things have been these issues for a long time. I was going to say there have been a number of articles I've been reading recently about the issue of the learning gap. And there are a number of experiments in New York public schools in which they have dramatically changed the school day. And they were able to do it without a dramatic increase in spending. For example, the children come to school at 7 a.m. and they leave at 7 o'clock at night. And during that time, they are in regular classes, but they're also doing some supervised study and extracurricular activities and so. Then on Saturdays, they show up at 8 a.m. in the morning and leave at 1 in the afternoon. And what they've discovered so far with this more intensive school day and coaching is that the students, regardless of their economic and social class, when they come into the schools, are attaining superior academic results. And one of the things I'd like to see us do with this committee is to investigate to schools like that that are making a real dramatic change in the way educational delivery system is being provided. I don't think all these issues that were just discussed are critical ones, but I don't think having 10 weeks off in the summer, by the way, they also start school in July for these children at risk. And I think that kind of intervention is what our state should have to think about, since we are facing in this state one of the larger divisions in learning outcomes, which is at risk of almost any state in the union. And so that would be a direction I'd like to see this committee investigate more carefully.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Benson. That's interesting that you bring that up, because here we have 5-6 people who are sharing experiences in different school districts, and some might say that we have engaged in some level of high school redesign, and yet none of us spoke to any new real model. It's a little bit of reiteration of some of the things that we have now known that go on in our schools for many years. I would just like to recap some of my experience. I went to a biology class, and the first thing that I noticed is that there were 32 kids. Of those 32 children, the first half of the class, the teacher was very actively involved with the material and the kids, and she tried the best that a teacher can to get the kids involved by having them circle things on their page or do several different little things to engage in the material. But the teacher was clearly the one who was actively involved. And along with her, I would say there were seven students who were engaged with her. And lo and behold, they were all boys, which I found very interesting. And then in the last 10 minutes of the class, they got to work in small groups to do a brochure type activity, and it just kind of struck me because I was there for the reason that I was. And she said, "And there is one computer here that you can use for your activity," and it was to gather pictures and look at different biomes throughout the world. And there's one computer there, and there was 10 minutes to do that. And when I walked in, I knew a lot of the kids because, as you know, I have three boys, and they are in that school system. And so the boys that got in their small little group said, "Oh, you know, Mrs. D, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm here because, you know, I'm chairing a committee, high school redesign, and we're looking at, you know, how we're looking at ways to get more, you know, mathematics, science, engineers out of the high school experience." And he said, "Oh, so that's why you're here in our science class." "Yep, that's exactly right, Brandon. Okay, how are we doing?" I said, "Well," I said, "are you going to be a scientist?" "No." "Mathematician?" "No." "Engineer?" "No." I said, "That's how we're doing." And actually, I know the child very well, and that child would be one that would be very conducive to that side of the brain type of career path. So that was interesting. The one thing I have to say is the behavior was excellent. It was just incredible. It was very incredible. You would have thought it was Ozzie and Harriet days. And so then I went to a calculus class, and that class was just slightly different because it was less students. The desks were in twos. There was the electronic whiteboard, Representative Benson, that you brought that bill for us last year. And I don't know if that was the thing that made the difference in the class or the teacher, and because I would say the teachers were equally good, just different. It could be day, ever, anything. There's so many variables, and I'm not stereotyping by any means. But the dynamics in that class were incredible. You know, the kids were working together and talking to each other about the problems, and they were interacting with this whiteboard, and the teacher, when the teacher was interacting with the whiteboard, it just seemed that much more attentive, and I don't know if I had these preconceived ideas, but I and everybody was involved. It was really incredible. And then I went to an IB math class and talked with those students a little bit about what I was doing and what they were doing, and I asked them what was the difference. And the advantage, the positive about an IB class, at least in our district, is they're much smaller class sizes, you know. So that's an interesting approach right there. And I asked the kids, you know, what is the difference between, you know, the IB math and the regular math? And they said, an IB class, they expect you to know the material when you get there. And what they were referring to was the material that had already been taught. They don't review. And I thought that was very interesting, because I had done some reading about that, that in our school systems we do expect that kids forget, and we spend a lot of time allowing them the ability to forget, because we review it for them quite well. So, any other comments, members? Representative Benson?
Well, I have to make up for the fact I didn't go to those classrooms. I'll just say I did spend 35 years in the classroom, so... But I will. Next time I'll have a good report.
Okay.
Some of you may have read the small article was in the St. Paul Pioneer Press today, titled Private School Advantage Disputed. And there have been a series of studies now concerning student learning outcomes between or among public schools and private schools. And they found out that the most important characteristic is how engaged parents were in their children's learning. And when those, when that was included, and also the economic status of the students and their parents, except on a couple of Catholic schools run by Jesuits, and my daughter went to a Jesuit-run college, so I think maybe I could understand this, because they have a long history of academic excellence. There were no differences. And with the discussions that have been going on about increasing student access to private schools, at a time of declining funding for the public schools, I think it would be useful for this committee to see if we could find a clear understanding of the role of the real role that parents do play in their students' learning, and whether or not there are some ways in which we could change that equation. In all the years I taught, I taught the advanced courses too. The issue, as I saw it, was never the fact that some students were so incredibly more intelligent than others. The key factor was the motivation and the parental expectations, and I think maybe you would support me in that. Well, if that's the case, then to me, we ought to be looking at a different organization of the school day for children at risk, and we ought to really focus on the role of parents in the children's learning. And I think that would be a really critical area that those two areas I don't think really have been looked at carefully, and I think that would be really useful, because otherwise we've been listening to whether it's the the education department or whomever, and we always get into the issue of there's simply not enough funds. You know, not enough funds to recruit and retain the kind of teachers we want. And all those things are true, but when I look at the budget in the next 3 years, I'm not sure we're going to be able to find the $1 billion the PS Minnesota suggests that we have to have. And if that's the case, then how about working on some of these other areas that we may have some impact on?
Thank you. Representative Swell.
You know, Representative Benson is a very wise man. And one of the things that I've always appreciated about him is that he gets to the heart of, I think, what the core issues are. And in education, you know, what happens in the classroom is just a small, tiny, it's like a little tiny snippet of a child's life. What happens to that child outside of my classroom, in the family, mm-hmm. and with their friends, there's a whole other dynamic at work there. And I would like to invite the committee to possibly consider a field trip to Woodbury, where we have the Math and Science Academy, which is a charter school. And I was kind of amused this past session as we were hearing testimony about possibly creating a science academy, Math and Science Academy for the state, thinking, I have one in my backyard. It's an excellent school. It consists of only 250 students. Their waiting list is far greater than the student body that they have. They have tremendous results. They have very the parents, part of the commitment of attending the school is that there is a high level of parental involvement. These students are involved in robotics. They're involved in taking college classes at the U. It's just amazing to me that things that they undertake, and their class sizes are very small. So there are some models that exist here in the state. I think we do need to look to our charter schools as maybe some examples of some creativity that's going on, because the public schools are limited by size or budgets, and I think perhaps we should explore some of those things and talk to the parents about what they want in a school and what they're getting from an experience like that.
Excellent comments, and we will take note of that. Those are excellent comments. Thank you very much. Representative Tilbury.
I have an interesting experience. I have a foreign exchange student living in my house, and she's going to be there for 3 weeks, and she's staying with my daughter, and my daughter will then, you know, join up with her in her house next time. But we were able to talk some education pieces with her. And in Germany, where they have three separate types of tracks that you can kind of go through, and they decide things at fourth grade, and then you're placed in that. But I just found it interesting. She was in one of the higher tracks of their educational system. But then I was looking at the types of jobs that her parents do, and one's a daycare mom, and then she delivers papers. You know, early morning papers in Germany, and her dad works in an electrical factory. I'm not exactly sure what he does there, but that's all I could find out at this point. But when I talked about the types of languages that she knows, I know German, obviously, but French, English, and I'm working on a little bit of Spanish, and I just found that amazing. Especially as well as she's communicating, and yet she doesn't think she's communicating very well at all, but she does very well. But then also she's 18 years old and expected to go another year, I believe, if not two. So it's a different system. I'm not necessarily saying one's, you know, what it should be, but it certainly is things to look at that are maybe successful. So I think we could also extend our reach outside of our own borders and look at other successful places.
Yes, and what I'd like to make sure that members feel like they have the ability to do that at any given time, you know, provide the feedback. We've tried to take a little bit of time before or after meetings to talk a little bit as a group with, you know, the book Who Moves My Cheese has been, you know, the impetus for some of that. And with this activity, and I think we should continue those types of discussions so that we make sure that each one of our needs get met by participating in this committee. Well, we're going to move away from the individual school experience now to a statewide experience, and tonight we are very fortunate to have Kent Pakel, Director of University of Minnesota's Consortium for Post-Secondary Academic Success, to present his vision for 21st century high schools. Before we do that, I want to talk just a little bit about his experience. Mr. Patel was most recently a senior policy associate for America's Choice, Inc., where he coordinated the launch of the State Alliance for High Performance, a national initiative to help states raise high school student achievement. Before this, he spent 5 years working in the leadership capacity for the St. Paul Public School System, including the position of Executive Director of Research and Development, where he led the school district's reform agenda. He has also served with the U.S. Department of Education, the State Department, and the White House in Washington, D.C., and as a classroom teacher at Jefferson High School in Bloomington, and as an English language instructor in China. So with that, Mr. Patel, would you like to come forward? And I will let you characterize your most recent work with the high school, what is your group right now? Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals. No, that's not you. University of Minnesota Consortium for Postsecondary Academic Success.
Thank you very much. I will actually get to what I'm doing at the university and what this new consortium is about in the course of this discussion. And let me say thank you, Madam Chair, for the invitation and to all the representatives for being here. I can tell there's a deep commitment to and a lot of experience with education around the table. And somehow, since I unexpectedly early left the classroom, my career has really focused on this nexus between policy and practice and what matters for kids in our classrooms. And strangely, that's where I've found my, at least my interests lie, and maybe some skill base, and that's where I'm working, surprisingly, for a card-carrying K-12 person, teacher and administrator. Now I find myself at the University of Minnesota, which actually turns out to be a really good place to be working to try and strengthen high schools. The only caveat I'd say is that what I'm going to describe really isn't my vision for the future of high schools. In part, it comes from a task force of high school leaders, the report of which you have at your places, that was prompted by the governor's statement that high schools are obsolete and that our students are academically loitering in them. And what the Secondary School Principals Association and some colleagues I knew well and I said was, let's get together, let's look at the data, let's look at the research, and let's decide how we move forward. And so the report you have there is the product of high school leaders from across the state, and I'll conclude with some thoughts about that at the end. The presentation that I'm going to walk you through, I hope in pretty quick, breezy form, because I know you've all had a long day, was one I gave last week in Duluth at the Minnesota Association of School Administrators Conference of our superintendents. And that was a revised version of a presentation I gave to our secondary, junior high, middle, and senior high administrators in Brainerd this summer. And I will tell you both times, on one hand I succeeded and on one hand I bombed. And I succeeded because they were deeply engaged, and I bombed because I depressed them. And I don't find this work depressing, but these are our school leaders on the front lines, and it was depressing. I said to both Charlie Kite and Joanne Knuth, you need me like the plague. Where I think this is a really positive, exciting, forward-looking message, if you're on the front lines, this is back-breaking change. And I think part of my thesis here, and Representative Dietrich, you said, you know, you talked about your classroom visits, and are you really talking about anything new, any kind of a new paradigm? My thesis really, and this is also not just from my years in the classroom, but years working on this stuff in St. Paul, is that seriously aligning high schools around the idea of college readiness for every student is a practical way to the radical. And if we take it seriously, it's a paradigm shift completely and totally, but it's one that actually is within the realm of the possible. So let me give you try and make that case to you in some pictures and graphs. And then hopefully it will inform your continuing deliberations. And again, I'll tell you what I'm doing at the university in the course of this discussion. So assuming this all works, let's start at the beginning. And I called this the quest for college material. That title is chosen deliberately for reasons I hope you'll see. And so like all good quests, this is a story. One of the things I realized after being with the secondary school principals in Brainerd this summer was this presentation was a little like Al Gore and global warming. It was bludgeoning people with charts and graphs. And so I said when I was with the superintendents last week, let me try and make it a story. I'm not sure I was very successful, but this story has a hero. And of course, like all stories, that hero has a problem. And the hero struggles with the problem, with, of course, the help of a great teacher there, as all of our heroes have to struggle with problems. Our hero finds a solution, another teacher. And our hero implements the solution, and our hero saves the day. Now, I'm not obsessed with Star Wars, actually, but I thought that this really is a story. It's a narrative, and I think all deep change follows a narrative. So I'm going to borrow the gimmick there that I just walked you through to hopefully paint that picture of a direction forward for high school. So who's the hero of our story? That's the hero of the story that frames this discussion. But, of course, here are the real heroes of this story. They're the students that are in our educational pipeline today. So why are students the heroes of this story? This is a quote that really I hope you'll take a second to take a look at. This is from Clifford Adelman, who's a researcher at the U.S. Department of Education, who's done some research that we'll talk about at the conclusion of this discussion. And in a paper that he did that really looked at what it's going to take to make sure students are ready to succeed in college, he called for a considerable change in the language we use in describing what happens to students, from a negative rhetoric that assumes passivity to one that respects students as active players seeking and discovering paths to their education goals. As our kids hit adolescence today in the United States, we can't think about changing high school as something that mostly the adults do to make things better. We have to find ways to make sure individual students own their educational journeys in a really directed way. That's what happens to our students who are on the right path now, and it needs to be our vision for all kids. So one of the things that you saw from the pictures that I just showed you there, the faces that I chose deliberately, don't look like most of our students in Minnesota today. This, more specifically, they were students from diverse cultures and backgrounds. You can see this chart, which I know is familiar to many of you, but I like it because it puts a trend that many of us see when we visit the classroom into an interesting breakdown. This is the districts in our state by level of density of students. So more than 100, Minneapolis and St. Paul are most dense districts, all the way down to our most sparsely populated districts. And what you can see is in terms of the percentage change in your demographics of your student population, we're seeing a percentage change decline in terms of the percentage of our white students in districts of all sizes in the state. Now, there are individual districts within each of these bands where the story is different, but in the aggregate across our most heavily populated and our most sparsely populated, the percentage change, white students are declining and students of color are increasing. So those faces that I showed you are the faces of Minnesota's future, and if we do nothing, they are dramatically less likely to end up succeeding in post-secondary education based on all of our outcomes as we know them now. So then let's turn to what's the problem. This is, again, the fact that you're here at the end of a long day indicates that you know this problem, but it really is that in the global information age, with the rapid expansion of globalization and the emergence of technology that can replace jobs we never imagined being able to be replaced, what you learn determines what you earn. You can see the difference there between a professional degree and less than a high school diploma. Some of you may have been around Mayor Ryback, who actually has visited every freshman for the last 2 years in Minneapolis Public Schools, and I was there twice when he did it. And he has kind of a useful gimmick, and I don't mean that derogatorily. He asks the kids, have you been to the million-dollar room? Have you been in the million-dollar room in this high school? And these are new freshmen, and they say, what? And if there was a room that I told you in this high school you could get $1 million, would you go? And yeah, I would go to that. And then he does his get to the College and Career Center, because if you have a college degree over the course of your life, and this chart tells you that, you'll make more than $1 million in lifetime earnings than somebody with a high school diploma. And as all of you know, that wage differential is rapidly increasing. So going back to our heroes, those students that we see in those pictures, if they're not on a path to educational attainment as is mapped out by these bar graphs, they're going to find themselves on the wrong side of the economic divide. And there's very little ambiguity left in that discussion. Even 5 years ago, there may have been. So the fact that what you learn determines what you earn is a problem for all kids. It's a huge problem for our students who struggle academically. You can see there, this is national data. Minnesota looks similar, actually somewhat worse for a number of different reasons in terms of gaps. You can see our graduation rates, where we were in 2002, 2003 nationally, with all students about 70%. There's different ways to measure graduation rates. This is using now what is generally the most widely accepted. And you can see Native Americans at 47%, African Americans at 52%, male African Americans at 44%, and Hispanic students at 56%. We know that story, and we know it's a crisis, and it's animated many of our discussions. And it has also caused us to focus, in terms of both what happens in classrooms and schools and in the policy arena, on high school graduation. We've got to get kids to high school graduation. We've got to get kids to high school graduation. And as I'll talk about, we spent 6 years focused on that objective when I was in St. Paul as well. So we know that this emergence of the information economy is a problem for these kids who are really on the wrong side of the achievement gap. In some ways, this graph is the same story in a way that we don't look at it as often. This is data from the College Board, and this is if you look at our 8th grade kids, just before the high school jumping off point, with the highest quintile of mathematical scores. And you look at where they end up in terms of their socioeconomic status years later earning a college degree, we see that kids from a low socioeconomic background are going to have earn a college degree at 29%. At a middle socioeconomic background, middle income 47%, and high income 74%. One of the things that this tells us is something is happening among our students in 8th grade who are scoring at the top in mathematics, which is the best predictor of college success. By the time they're getting to the end of the college pipeline, an awful lot of things are intervening, and the outcomes at the end of the rainbow are very dramatically different. So we know that that's the reality within the United States, but we also know that in this interdependent world, this really is the context in which we're thinking about these issues. This is a slide from the Minnesota Public College Council that I borrowed from them, and when I first borrowed it a couple of years ago, 2008 seemed remote. It seemed like this was going to be change that was somewhere far in the future, and of course 2008 is almost upon us. And as many of you know, educational outcomes in that part of the world are rising dramatically. And one of the things that's interesting, there was a report that came out in the early 1990s that was from the organization I worked for between St. Paul and the university. And it was called America's Choice, High Skills or Low Wages. And that was one of the first times people were saying, my goodness, the United States has got to set the bar higher or our people are going to have low wages. In the intervening 15, 17 years, the rise of China and India as high-skill labor markets, I think, has flipped that equation on its head with perilous implications for us in the United States. With the rise of China, where I've spent a good amount of time and where I taught, we have the frightening prospect of high skills and low wages. So this traditional dichotomy on which we've depended is really, at least for the foreseeable future, being turned on its head. So you see why I depressed the principals and the superintendents with this presentation, but I do think we carry it in some different directions. This is the trend bar that shows that international perspective when we're looking at college completion. And if you look there, you can see this is comparing the difference in the percent of the workforce with an associate's degree, a 2 or 4 year degree or higher, from age 20 to 34, our recent graduates, compared to 45 to 54. When you look at this graph, you see what is really a striking reality, which is to say our young adults in the United States, you see that red bar at the end, are actually less likely to have associate's or bachelor's degrees than the older generation, whereas almost all of the rest of those countries have dramatically increased their production of post-secondary degrees. After World War II, of course, Korea, France, Japan, those countries were either decimated or not developed. They've made dramatic progress. We have generally plateaued in the degree production, meaning persistence to completion in the United States. So you can see we are, along with Brazil and Germany, one of the few countries that is on the other end of that scale. And if you think back to the bar graphs around individual income and educational attainment, this has some frightening implications for us. This is national data. If we had more time, there's Minnesota data that I will tell you tells the same story in some interesting and different ways that we can get into in discussion if you're interested. So at one point, I recently saw driving to work this bumper sticker that if we don't change direction, we're going to get where we're going. And that I think there is significant reason to think that that is something we should be concerned about, and obviously you are by being here. So I said that our next phase of this is that our hero is struggling with this problem. What's the problem? And I want to be careful by calling it a problem. This actually is the old version of the high school that I graduated from 20-whatever years ago, Central High School in St. Paul. And it was then an extraordinary place, and it still is in so many kids. But as you can see, I chose this old picture of it, and the cars and the clothes in front don't look like the kids you'd see in front of Central today. But I submit, and this is with great respect, in fact, the principal of Central High School co-chaired the task force that wrote the report you have, there really is a different model that's animating that school. I found this quote from 1918. The National Education Association convened a commission on the reorganization of secondary education. Really was a seminal report, and they came up with their cardinal principles of secondary education. And you can see it there. They concluded that the work of the senior high school should be organized into differentiated curriculums. The basis of differentiation should be, in the broad sense of the term, vocational, thus justifying the names commonly given, such as agricultural, business, clerical, industrial, fine arts, and household arts curriculums. Provisions should be made also for those having distinctly academic needs and interests. And the reason I pulled this quote out was you can see there the absolute clear distinction between the vocationally oriented and the academically oriented. You know what? That worked. It worked for kids for generations. This was an approach for its day that was extraordinarily progressive. And this was a time in which most American kids, when they wrote this report, didn't complete 12 years of compulsory education. And this vision helped to move high school to being compulsory. And so now the notion that we wouldn't set the bar of high school out for all kids as the objective seems ludicrous. But at that time, it absolutely was a radical new idea. So our students, our heroes, are encountering this problem, which is to say they're preparing for that new world, that new economic paradigm, in a different with high schools that are rooted in the last paradigm. And so many people, myself included, have been calling for a new 3 R's of high school education. And I know many of you know these. They're rigor, relevance, relationships, were how we talked about it in St. Paul. When the governor gave his speech, he talked about results instead of relationships. Our response would have been, you can't get the results without the relationships. But however you describe it, there has been a desire to talk about these and other goals as the outcome of high school change. And we're more than a decade into efforts to raise graduation rates by making high schools more personal, more rigorous, and the curriculum more broadly relevant to what comes next. How has it worked? And this is where the presentation seems to get really depressing. This is national data, which is not breakable, can't be broken down into Minnesota data because of the way the test is administered, but broadly stated, I think that our state assessments have reflected this as well. This is the NAEP test, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card. And if you take a look at this, you'll see that our 12th graders are actually scoring lower in 2005 than they were in 1992. And there's been no significant change since 2002. So let's shift from reading to math. With math, they put a new test in 2005, and so we can't give a trend data. But you can see that actually, in fact, only 23% performed at or above the proficient level in mathematics. The results on our 11th grade MCA test last year, though it's a new test and people are going to take time to get used to it, broadly confirmed that when our kids get to the upper grades of high school, they're really struggling with advanced content in math. And then finally, high school science. We're seeing that it is, by a narrow margin, statistically significant. The broad point is it's flat. Now, the key thing, though, is, and this is a difficult reality for myself as somebody who considers himself focused on high schools and secondary education. If we had more time, I could have shown you graphs from the same assessment, the NAEP test for our elementary kids, that show significant improvement, especially in mathematics. elementary schools have increasingly been able, even including with our most challenged kids, to make significant progress. And we know that when we look at our tests internationally, our fourth graders do pretty well, our eighth graders are in the middle of the pack, and our 12th graders are near the, at best, the top of the bottom. One thing I don't like about that soundbite is it implies it's the same kids at every point of that time. It actually is the same snapshot of the same kids. So the fourth graders who did pretty well internationally may persist through school, and by the time they're in eighth grade, they'll actually be doing quite well also. So I think you have to be a little careful about that soundbite that a couple of presidents and the governor likes to use, that our 12th graders don't do as well. It suggests that it's necessarily the same kids getting worse. But something deep is happening in our upper grades, which of course is why we're here. Why do I highlight the rigor, relevance, and the relationships piece as part of the discussion? Here's what, and some of you may have seen this before, I got it from when I visited a high school in Texas. If you define this as a formula for change, you got a vision, you got the skills, you got the incentive to change, you got resources, and you have an action plan. You have a hard-headed plan to move forward. Well, if you have all of those things but no vision, you get confusion. And if you have all of them but no skills, you get anxiety. If you have all of them but no incentive, you get resistance. If you have all of them but no resources, you get frustration. And if you have everything but no action plan, you're on a treadmill. Now, my sense is that one piece, all of those boxes are your jobs as legislators and our jobs as educators. My sense is that one of the pieces of high school reform that has been critically missing is the vision box. It's that vision point where we end up with confusion. And that comes down to, for me, this. If you're let's just say that, as I have been, you're inspired by rigor, relevance, and relationships. I remember when I heard that, I just thought, that is the best thing, that's what we need, and our high schools don't work like that. But if you're a high school teacher, how do you walk into the classroom every day and do rigor? My job is rigor. Rigor is going to sound like harder, faster, louder. How do I do relationships? You already have relationships, but several of you talked about the 38 kids in the class. Those are descriptors of high-functioning schools. We all know it when we see it. But are they things that an individual student can invest in and say, that's where I'm headed? Or are they things that an individual teacher or principal can say, this is why I'm coming to work every day? And you can tell my hard-learned lesson, even though in St. Paul doing this work, graduation rates went up, they went up for all student groups, the progress was nowhere near where we need to be for our kids in the information age. So I did say that our hero finds a solution, and as I mentioned, my thesis is that the solution can be college readiness for all. Now, a couple of critical points. When I say college, it's defining it broadly, including technical college, community college, and four-year college. The term that's a bit more appropriate is post-secondary, but I'll tell you, when I talk with students, which I do not subject them to this long PowerPoint, post-secondary does not register as a term. What does it mean? It's defining it as something after something, whereas the term college has tremendously positive implications. But it's really important to stress that I mean college here broadly. And in fact, college is the wrong term because it seems to suggest a four-year degree for everybody. Then we need to probably adjust the term. The goal is readiness, not necessarily enrollment, which is to say that if we sort kids, some of you were talking about that. I mean, I've got a nephew, and my own kids are just getting, my oldest is getting toward junior high. If we begin to put kids onto that pre-advanced placement or not track, the algebra and junior high are not tracked, we're beginning to make a decision for them very, very early about their outcome. And so the goal, when I talk about readiness here, and when we at the university think about it, it's not necessarily saying that every kid will even enroll, but they all are ready enough academically and in terms of the soft skills, habits of persistence, ability to work with others, that they meaningfully have the choice and they can meaningfully consider the options. And that college readiness is a goal that students, teachers, parents, administrators, parents, and the community can understand and embrace. They can't do it if we just throw it out there as a buzzword. But some of you have probably noticed the ACT, the American College Testing Corporation, that 70% of Minnesota kids take that test. Very quietly along the way in the last several years, they've determined their own definition of college readiness, which they got from looking at the grades that their test takers got in four-year institutions and then looking back to the scores they got on the ACT, they publish college readiness rates for every Minnesota test taker every year. So there are lots of different ways to define readiness, but it's something that if we roll up our sleeves, it's a complex idea that could be made practical and tangible. I mentioned the ACT. This is a graph from the Governor's Education Council report, and I'm not even going to go into the craziness of some of those goals that you see there. They're actually calling for improvements in very, very hard to improve indicators that nobody's ever achieved anywhere at any point, which is to say that you would get improvements for 5 and 6 years running of double digits in gigantic test gates. So let's almost ignore the goals there. You can take a look at the first column, which are actual readiness rates as the ACT defines them, and 70% roughly, 65 to 70% of Minnesota high school grads take the ACT every year. You can see that for all kids, they said, for meaning you hit the readiness bar in all four core subjects, 28% of all students were ready, according to ACT. The American Indian, 13%, and you can see the other numbers. This is not to suggest that the ACT definition of readiness is one that we necessarily should embrace in Minnesota. It certainly is one that I think is going to be increasingly relevant because our individual kids are taking that assessment and it's very high stakes. There's another assessment that's given mostly in community college and other institutions with the AccuPlacer. They have cut scores as well. The broad concept here is what would it look like if you organized high schools comprehensively around ensuring that every kid is ready? Quick point, what about workforce readiness? It's an issue that people talk about. We're going to have students go into the workforce, and we really want them to be able to get high-skilled jobs like electrician that you can support a family on, the number of them is projected to grow in the future, and you can advance within the career field. The Gates Foundation, the National Governors Association, they always say college and workforce readiness. One of the things that I would, and the ACT again has done some studies that suggest that in reading and math, college readiness and readiness for those high skill fields is similar. One thing I would urge us to think about is if we give high schools two bars to aim for, college readiness and workforce readiness, are we actually putting ourselves back into that same factory model where we're going to have a different bar set for different kids? Or if we have one common high objective, do the students who choose to go directly into the workforce but had the opportunity to go on to post-secondary education, were they best served by their high schools? And the other point, especially for those of you who are working in schools, if we don't at some point take something off the to-do list of our high schools, we're going to get nowhere. So when people understandably raise this question of workforce readiness and shouldn't that also be the goal, one way potentially to think about that is to say yes, if you're ready for rigorous post-secondary education, you're quite likely ready for the workplace that we want you to be able to succeed in. That's a theory that we need to play with. So how do we get from here to there? We talked about our hero implementing the solution. I want to just highlight four points, and I decided to focus on not my own experience or even what we're seeing from the university, but research. There's a researcher who was just retired from the U.S. Department of Education who first took a look, Cliff Edelman, at what does it take to earn a BA or a BS? And he found that if you take what we traditionally call a college preparatory curriculum, so 4 years of English, significantly more than 3 years of math, 3 years of science, including lab science, 2 years of foreign language, at least one AP course, computer science course, there's a 95% chance you'll complete a BA. And what he found is if you don't do that, your chances of completion are dramatically less. The best predictor of success toward a college degree is the rigor of your high school curriculum, how tough is what you take, and the best subject area within that is math, and the tipping point to completing a BA is now firmly above Algebra 2. It's now at least trigonometry pre-calc because the world has gone quantitative. And we don't have any good aggregate data in Minnesota on high school course taking, but the sample that's done every year by the national think tank that produces the National Center on Higher Education and Public Policy that produces a measuring up report suggests that only 46% of Minnesota kids are taking advanced math, only 29% of Minnesota kids are taking advanced science, and that's significantly below the top states on both measures. So the first piece is course taking. Are you taking the right courses? The second researcher at the University of Oregon, David Conley, has looked at this extensively. It's not just the name on the transcript, it's what's in the course. And so making sure our teachers and others who are very committed to preparing students for college and post-secondary understand what college-level content really is, what do students really need to know and be able to do in college algebra. And we have very few mechanisms to help them understand that. And I know Cindy Cripps from the State Colleges and Universities is here. They've had some faculty members who've done fascinating work getting post-secondary instructors and their campuses together with high school teachers and asking them to compare student writing and say what's college ready and what's not. And you've seen a dramatic discrepancy where our high school teachers are saying writing that passes the Minnesota writing test is college ready, and our post-secondary instructors finding it almost universally not to be ready for college-level writing. Well, what's our mechanism for helping those teachers understand what that content is? Third, in very few countries are secondary and post-secondary education as misaligned. We heard somebody was talking about Germany earlier. In the U.S., we really leave it to individual kids to make the jump from secondary to post-secondary. And that's not going to change. We're not going to suddenly merge school districts and the University of Minnesota. But we don't send very clear signals to students and families up the way. One of you was talking about which courses to take and getting grades. There's a widespread perception among our students that it's better to take easier courses and get better grades and a higher class rank and a higher GPA than to take tougher classes and do worse. And those of you who dealt with higher education know that's exactly wrong, and that every institution of higher education immediately relates that transcript to look at the rigor of the course taking. But the degree to which we're giving that message to our kids and our counselors and others who are working with them is very random. It has to do with people getting that message. One other example, a lot of our students, especially our students, low-income students, know that community colleges don't have quote-unquote admission standards. So what I do in high school doesn't matter that much because I know I can get into X. Well, that is true if you earn the high school diploma, but the reality is you're not going to get into credit-bearing courses for maybe a year if you're really behind. And then what happens to those students is they think they're in quote-unquote college, but they've burned up their scholarship dollars and they haven't earned any credits. And the discouragement factor hits and they don't persist because there was this perception that I can definitely get in to, I'm not going to go to Carleton, I can get in there and I don't need to work that hard because I know I can get in there. Well, the reality is you're not going to begin earning credits there until you demonstrate proficiency in a credit-bearing course. The message that the signals getting to kids and families are quite limited. And even for a lot of us who talk about advanced placement and international baccalaureate, for a lot of our communities that don't come from a background in which they have personal experience with that kind of coursework, they don't know that's something to encourage their kids to bite off. And so we've got to get those messages out. And finally, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is the major international organization of the developed countries, has done some fascinating research on the highest performing educational systems in the world. And what they found, to break it down to a science soundbite, is that high-performing systems provide high challenge but also high support and really intensive support for students. What does that look like? One example is safety nets. Where do you go if you're not ready? Our high schools have always had safety nets for our most struggling students, the ninth grader who reads at a fifth grade level. But do we have safety nets for the kid who is not mastering Algebra 2? Or did we just say some kids don't really get Algebra 2, and so that's okay? Well, the reality is Algebra 2 is foundational now. We have to find whether it's a double period or you all talked about after school. That's where I talk about this vision as a practical way to the radical. That's suddenly saying, whoa, we have to have safety nets for kids not who can't read, we need that too, but for kids who can't begin to do this, what used to be called gifted and talented content. I won't go into this in any depth, but the University of Minnesota and President Blumix is personally very engaged in this, knew that we could not sit and wait for students to continue to show up on the doors of the university ready for college-level work. So we're attempting to work at three levels to begin to build the pipeline to higher education. At the state level, we are working with other K-12 and higher ed and other institutions on the P16 partnership, which, as many of you know, is the long-standing, 4 or 5 years statewide effort to align these systems, align college readiness standards into our K-12 standards, and President Brunix will be chairing that for the next couple of years. We're also working with K-12 leaders on a more grassroots effort called Minnesota's Promise. In the first year of this consortium, we've also launched something called the Minnesota Principals Academy, which, of course, was a state-supported initiative. Senator Steve Kelly initially launched it, and the governor, as the commissioner, supported it. And I'll come back to that very briefly. And at the student level, we're introducing an individual student readiness plan that we hope to get students starting in 6th or 7th grade developing the knowledge, skills, and habits they need to truly be ready to succeed in higher education. A quick point on the Minnesota Principals Academy. It's an effort that brings our school leaders together over the course of a year for 2 or 3 days a month. 74 principals from across the state have gone through the program. They start out with vision and missions, and they move through leadership and literacy and safety nets to driving for results. And the reason I wanted to mention this as a core component of high school reform is one of the hard lessons I learned over that time in St. Paul. We really started with teacher leaders who wanted to improve high schools, and it was great. And we didn't start with the leaders. And we had to continually play catch-up, which is to say the principal is so key. And one, building the capacity of our school leaders to lead this vision. And so you can see there at the center of the model that we spend a year with on these leaders in the Principals Academy is college readiness for all students. The reason I mention the academy is not just because I think it's a great option, but we had $800,000 in state design money and startup money. The program was not refunded at the end of the last session, and we're keeping it alive with university and soft dollars, but I will submit that it's a train-the-trainer model, and we've had 2 applicants for every principal who's gone through the program, and so I think unambiguously one of the best things we can do to move whatever vision of high school reform you have forward is to continue that program and scale it out across the state. Another point, a final point, an almost final point, that task force report, if it indicates anything, it's that this idea of aligning secondary and post-secondary education, neither side of the equation has the answers. It's not about higher ed asking high schools, what do you need, and it's not about high schools asking higher ed, what do you need, because we're both stuck in a different paradigm in which our basic mission was to sort kids by ability. And so we really have to go back to first premises and say, what is it going to take to prepare kids to do things that we never thought they could do today. So I said it ends with the hero saving the day. So we're living through some important paradigm shifts. I mentioned before where you remember the days, there was a hundred years ago where 12 years of high school education was a radical notion. I think if we do this work right, 20 years from now we'll say, remember the days when people thought education stopped at high school. So we're really living through that change. What does it mean? It's a nice soundbite, but how do we actually make it happen? The second paradigm shift I would suggest is we really were at a point where we thought that students learn based on the aptitude or the inherited ability they brought into the classroom. And now we're saying, you know what? Learning comes from effort. And of course, effort requires support. And I would just say, if I had to way oversimplify the single biggest difference between the time I've spent in a Minnesota classrooms and Chinese classrooms, it's not the caliber of the teachers, and it's not the system, and there's very little of those things that I would suggest we borrow from the Chinese setting. But there is this deep sense in Chinese classrooms and culture that smart's not what you're born, it's what you become. It's what you work to become. And that with effort and support, every student has the potential to get to that point. And there's no phrase in terms of this work I'm doing at the university that better captures that than college material. College material really suggests that it's something that's encoded in the DNA of certain kids. You're college material and you're not. Whereas we've got to shift to the point where we see that as potentially in every kid's DNA, college broadly defined, and that we work to mine that gold over time. So that's the end of this this kind of whirlwind tour through how I would urge you to think about high school reform and redesign. And it sounded like as a final point, maybe some of you have been reading the cheese book, the Move My Cheese, or that you've talked about that. As I look back at it, one thing that's pretty clear from that is you're going to move your cheese dramatically faster if you have a vision of new cheese. If you don't have a vision of new cheese, you're not going to move your cheese through the maze faster. You're just going to run around the maze. And I apologize for those of you who haven't read that book. We used it with all the principals in St. Paul, and it's corny, but it does make this point. That we've got to give our students, our teachers, and our principals a clear vision of what high school reform is leading towards. And I think a good place to start that discussion is secondary readiness. So that's what we're doing, and I wish you well, and want to be helpful, not just today, but in as part of an ongoing discussion.
Thank you very much. I have lots of comments and thoughts, and what kind of time frame are you on?
I'm fine. I know that one of the colleagues that I had suggested you meet with, and I'll just mention it again, so if his schedule works, there's a lot of places you could talk to, including here in the urban core. Forsyth High School has got a principal who's gone through the Principal's Academy, Steve Massey, who is passionate about this, and I think one reason I suggested that he join you, and I suggest maybe you think about it. When you talk to someone like me collecting a check from the university, I'm going to come at this very much from readiness for a four-year college, and Steve also really brings to life this vision of readiness in his school for technical and other post-secondary options. So this doesn't need to just be about advanced placement and IB. So I know Steve can't be here, so I can kind of maybe fill in with some of that discussion, but also I know you could have a good discussion among yourselves, so don't hesitate to kick me out.
Okay. Members, any questions, comments?
Madam Chair, I'm really glad that you brought it up that schools, both post-secondary and high schools, getting together and working this through rather than saying, what do I need from this, and you know, that kind of a thought process. One of the schools in my district, however, they sent some people to talk to me because I was on this design team, and they had said that they're kind of in a unique problem. They have students that are avoiding AP classes in order to take post-secondary classes. And then they get credit through the post-secondary enrollment program for a class in college that sounds tougher, but it isn't. And the curriculum in the college course then isn't close to the AP-driven course. So they're having a hard time with that. And it's kind of interesting too, because I don't think the post-secondary enrollment program has even been overhauled in any way, shape, or form for the last however many years. And so I was just curious how your thoughts were on that.
I've heard that, especially since I've not been just in St. Paul, but as for the last year looking statewide, I've heard that again and again, especially from schools in greater Minnesota, especially those that are really close geographically to a post-secondary institution where it just is possible for kids to go. There's a real, again, anecdotally, there's a strongly felt perception among teachers, administrators, and counselors that I've talked to that kids may be opting out of more rigorous courses within the high school for options that, it may not even be that they're less rigorous, but there's a question of, are they providing the foundational content that kids need to go on? I mean, we know that kids have got to get the content that is in Algebra 2/trigonometry to be ready to do higher level work, and if you've got students taking an applied class that may be wonderful, we got to make sure they're getting that content through that class. And you're right, we haven't taken a systemic look at what it's, there's one piece of the puzzle is post-secondary options, but you also could maybe more broadly say dual credit, which is to say it's a high school course that awards credit from some kind of post-secondary institution, and that might be something that we ought to put under the microscope. Not because it's something we should or shouldn't do, but are we making sure students are getting that foundational content? Because it is interesting that at a time when we're integrating standards into all of our classes and adopting credit requirements, none of those apply if the kid takes a PSEL class. Sometimes that's probably a really good thing. Sometimes it's probably something we need to take a look at.
So just to follow up on that, Representative Tilbury, what do you think is the internal reason for taking the off-campus course as opposed to what's offered right in the high school?
Is that a question me or for the representative?
Both.
Is that a question me or for the representative?
Both of you.
I'll let you take it. At it first.
You know, but oversimplifying it, part of it may be that question of avoiding some tough challenge. My gut is that the majority, however, is because that post-secondary experience is positive and exciting and often a more applied experience in a lot of cases. We just got to face the reality that desks and rows and overheads are not going to work for a lot of our kids. And many of you know the STEP program at Anoka Technical College, and if you go out there, it's just alive with high school students who are absolutely engaging in very high-level content in a very applied setting. And the desks and rows overhead worksheet lather, rinse, repeat model for them is just not going to work. So I should be clear that in saying I've heard the same concern and we probably need to take a look at it, the majority of kids, I would venture, who decide to take the risk to go be on a post-secondary campus are probably doing it for the right reasons.
Representative Tilbury, do you have something to add to that?
Well, I think you answered it real well because, you know, I've seen it both types. And I look at even my daughter taking a CSEO class at the University of Minnesota, you know, in literature, but yet she has AP courses back in her schedule, back in her in the home school that she has. And so I've seen that, and of course I hear it out of her mouth both ways, that it would like to go to college in that class, and I think it's a great class, but it doesn't have the content that an AP course would have. It's a different direction. So I think that there's both of those reasons.
When you both refer to content, I just think back to what I know of high school, which is extremely limited. And I wonder, how do kids know content of a course before they take it?
Friends, word of mouth. Don't do that. It's too hard. Don't take it with that person. It's too hard. I hear it all the time.
I hear it all the time around my kitchen table. With my children and their friends.
And if I could just add again into my depressing mantra, but these are opportunities because I really do believe we're going to turn the corner on this. Even if they know the content of the class, do they have a sense of what they need to get to achieve their long-term goals from their classes? So even just putting the syllabus and the outcomes in front of kids is rare. But then even if you do that, do they know what they need to be looking for to get to their objective? Because they all have these aspirations. That's one of the things. We don't have an aspirations gap. There's another chart I didn't inflict on you tonight that shows three bars of post-secondary completion in the U.S., and they're static. And the bar that goes dramatically up every one of those years is the number of students on surveys who say, I plan to go to college. So our completion has been static, but our aspirations have been going up exponentially. So they have these aspirations. Are we giving them the clear sense of what they need to be doing in choosing their courses and then in how hard they work in them to get to their goals?
Mm-hmm. Representative Benson.
Well, I'd just like to piggyback on that a little bit. I'm in favor of post-secondary options. I'm in favor of all kinds of options. I remember when that was first being debated, I actually testified before a sort of legislative committee, I don't know if it was in the Senate or the House, 20 years ago now, but I was teaching advanced placement at that time. My objection was that I felt an assumption that if one took this course in a post-secondary setting, it was superior to an advanced placement class. So I had a modest proposal, which was that the students in the post-secondary classes were required to take the same college test, the same test as my students in advanced placement. And that was met by universal horror and disgust. And the idea was, well, that is the serious thing we've ever heard, because we all know the college professors are much more qualified and do a much better job than a high school teacher. And I've noticed that reform has never been proposed by any college or university. And I'd like to follow up just with one point. And this came up when college and I wrote a course which we called Political Economy to the University of Minnesota College in the School of Program and taught Macro Micro AP and American Government Politics AP. With these students, and the team taught it. And I remember one professor, I won't mention which private college it was, was horrified by the fact that we teachers were teaching this, and was complaining that instead of doing this, we ought to be working more diligently to see that all students were prepared to do college work. And then complained about the vast amount of money that our college was spending in remedial courses for students coming. And my response was, it would be the most salutary thing for public schools a red stamper on the forehead and said, "I'm sorry, you're not prepared for college," spun him around and sent him back to that secondary school. There's no incentive if getting the view or people in the college level are simply allowing them in regardless of the skills they come prepared for. And, you know, some of us have the suspicion that the issue is tuition may play a role in what secondary colleges and other institutions are seeking or take them because there's money. And all institutions want to grow and prosper. How do you react to those?
I agree. I would say, not be flippant at all. First of all, the paradigm shift that needs to happen in how higher education, including University of Minnesota, thinks about these issues is as deep as K-12. That's not my job portfolio, but it's another interesting discussion. The front-end piece that you raise is, however, I would suggest that part of the reason to bite off this tough work of defining readiness is that regardless of the admissions decisions that higher ed institutions make, we do have some shot at beginning to get at what you were raising, which is spinning the kid around. Now, the problem is, we're talking about spinning him around because the message is, you're going to get in, but you're not going to succeed because you're not ready. That's really the message that I'm suggesting we need to focus on, because the hard reality is the University of Minnesota recruits three classes into the future, and the demographic shift, the current sophomore class in our high schools that we're on, the biggest is the senior class. The class that the university is beginning to look ahead to is 10% smaller in the aggregate across the whole state than the two cohorts ahead of it. The reality is, just in terms of, unless colleges are prepared to shrink significantly, the pressure to get in is going to get that easier, not harder.
Right.
But then the progress toward completion is going to be as difficult. And so I guess it's saying that it doesn't go nearly as far as the interesting ideas that you proposed then, but at minimum we've got to give kids and families and teachers a better way to gauge readiness for success in post-secondary, even if the difficult reality is they're still going to gain admission if they have a high school diploma to a lot of our institutions.
Representative Brown had, I believe, talked about the issue of grade inflation in the secondary schools, and he certainly fought when I was still in the classroom. It certainly happened at the university and college level. So, whatever the university and the college administrative people doing concerning that? Is it a bell curve or what?
Candidly, having been there for just a year and being very focused on the K-12 piece of the pipeline without direct responsibilities for those undergraduate issues, I don't want to do more than say that it isn't a subject of discussion, because I'd be going way out on a limb to tell you that the university, at least, or other institutions are doing more than that right now. I'll tell you that one thing, I spent 2 days last week with Larry Gray, who's the head of our math department at the university, and one interesting point, he certainly is a faculty member who's very committed to both rigor in research and undergraduate education, but also tons of time on the front end with K-12. The university made a difficult decision, which is one that places like Berkeley and Michigan and Madison had made long ago, to raise admissions requirements, and it found its most difficult expression in closing the general college.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things Larry told me last week, and so the entry point for students who were academically less prepared to the university, the number of those students is decreasing. There's some early indication that GPAs among students at college-level mathematics at the university are significantly decreasing. So that the rigor is still staying there, but we're finding that more students are taking regular mathematics classes at the UN may be struggling. Now, I'm way out on a limb beyond my both expertise and my job portfolio, but that's why I say I can tell you it's a subject of discussion among faculty and among leadership, which is to say, how rigorous and how fairly are we evaluating undergraduate success after you, what we're doing about it. I can tell you several people that I work for would be eager to come talk with you about that if you're interested in it.
That's a quick one. The reason I mentioned that is I talked to particularly a very significant number of people in the business community who are complaining that their new hires competency level, but also the motivation. The work ethic seems to be declining. Did you run across that kind of discussion?
Again, I have run across it in spades when it's the discussion is K-12, which is both, you know, my experience and my current work. I haven't had that conversation about college graduates, but that's just because that's not the world that I'm spending my time in right now. So I just want to be really stick to where I feel like I'm on fairly solid ground and telling what I've seen and heard. I've heard it again and again and again about our high school graduates in the workplace. The college graduate piece is not something I've heard very often, but it certainly would be troubling if that's the case.
Thank you.
And I have a couple more that I would like to do momentarily, if I may.
I always love hearing from your representative. I just am very pleased with the things that you shared with us this evening. You have solidified so many of the things that we've been trying to put together for the last several weeks. I, too, was able to go to Texas last spring. I was part of the group that went down of legislators from across the nation to visit the Through the Gates Foundation,
okay.
the work that they were doing in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was particularly impressed with the way Texas is approaching the P16 tool, I guess is what I would call it. And when Commissioner Siegman was here a few weeks ago, I asked a very question about P16, because in our discussions in both K-12 finance and K-12 policy, or P-12 policy, we have not heard much discussion at all about P16. And when I was in Texas, I was just so thoroughly delighted when I heard people from the business community are working with the college community, who are working with the high school and elementary community, and they are scaffolding the skills needed in order to produce the workers that we've been talking about for this 20th century workforce that we need. And I am very delighted to hear that President Brunix is going to be heading this for the next 2 years, but I feel like that is happening in a vacuum. I'm not meaning to be critical of that group, but we have not had any discussion of the P16 group here at the legislature, and I think it's about time that we get pulled into that discussion and part of that group. I think if we're going to be passing legislation that affects policy in our schools and in our colleges, that we need to do something that aligns it with the needs of the businesses and the colleges, and that colleges make it clear to the high schools what their expectations are for entry into their curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a breakdown of communication. If I had to indict anything about what I'm seeing, my students, when I prepare them in AP English, I know that they are rock solid prepared when I send them off. But I don't know into what I am sending them. And that is very frustrating for me as a high school teacher. And I feel like you're in agreement with me on that, but I don't know how we make that connection with that committee and with that work that's being done.
Representative Sprouls, that reminds me of the bumper sticker. You know, if we don't know where we're going, you know, what good does it do? And
right.
How do we know which direction to change?
Right.
And so but I'm sure you have some comments.
Well, I'll be brief. Let me say, Senator.
Yeah.
Senator Rummel made this point to me earlier this week, and Representative Greiling has made it as well, which is to say about the P16 and partnership in particular, which, as I'm sure you know, it doesn't have a budget or a staff, and it's everybody pitches in, which is different than how some other states like Texas have done it. The president literally chaired his first full meeting last week of the partnership, and one outcome of that was that the president and Commissioner Siegman are going to be, and in fact will be in touch next week, offer to meet with all of the relevant education, higher education committee chairs to begin a discussion about the work of P16 and the legislature's engagement or desire to be engaged in that effort. What the university proposed and that the P16 partners, and there's 26 of them, have approved last week are four working groups. The first is a working group to attempt, and I think will succeed, to come up with exactly what you were just referring to, a Minnesota definition of post-secondary and workforce readiness. Can we as a state do what some other states have done and come up with a definition we agree to? I'll say that's easier said than done because it needs to be a definition that can work for students who are on very different trajectories. But that's the first working group. Can we come up with a clear definition that students and you as a teacher can use? The second is the science standards revision. We've completed the math and English language arts working groups that P16 had to integrate college readiness standards into our K-12 standards revision. Those working groups have made recommendations to the standards revision process. The next one we're proposing is science. That's going to be more of a challenge because there are less clearly acknowledged national benchmarks for college readiness and science than there are reading and English language arts and mathematics. But there are national best practice frameworks that the scientific and science education communities have developed. So the second working group is the science standards renewal. The third is science instruction, attempting to help our K-12, including elementary school educators, really understand best practices in instructing students in science. So it's not just the standards, it's how you teach the standards. And the fourth and final working group that has been agreed to at this point is a data systems working group. We have finally, through the previous work of P16, crossed the divide of saying schools and districts need to tack some digits onto the MARS number for kids, and institutions of higher education need to tack some digits onto the higher education identifier, so that if everything goes as planned, and I don't mean to suggest that I think it won't, in the coming years we will have one way to track students in Minnesota from pre-K to 12 through higher education. There's been a lot of privacy and data systems issues to work through to get just to that point of agreement to do it, and now people actually have to redesign their databases and make it happen. So that working group is really going to try and sustain the course, but when you talk about places like Texas and Florida and others, they really can push a button and tell you how many kids are taking Algebra 2 in the state, updated continually. We aren't at that point for lots of different reasons, one of which is this common student identifier. So those are the four working groups that will be in place during President Brunick's tenure as chair, and we'll be glad to continue the conversation with you about how we can make sure that you're both aware of that work, and as I mentioned, the president as chair and Commissioner Stephen as vice chair are going to be getting together with committee chairs in the coming month or two to engage this discussion that has come up several times.
Yeah, I would just like to comment that eventually we would like the individual working groups to come and talk to us about what they are doing also. I have one topic that I want to bring up because as I've been reading a lot about high school redesign, there is a real strong consistency that, you know, math, science, reading, English, writing, all those things are the core subject areas, and they need to continue to be strong, and we need to continue to improve on those. But what I am reading about a lot lately is some other higher level thinking skills, problem solving, innovative thought process, higher level thinking skills. And I have heard nothing from you on that today. Is that in your vision at all, and can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm really glad. In fact, that's yet another thing I need to improve in how we talk about this stuff, because you're right, it wasn't there. Those are really the thing we're all after. It really is those higher order thinking skills. One way that this task force, the report of which you have in front of you, found one framework for thinking about that these high school principals and others that we worked with last spring found to be really interesting, and the citation is in one of the footnotes in that report, is a national effort that took place over the last couple of years called the Partnership for 21st Century Skills. And you can find it on the web if you Google it. It was educational leaders, business, nonprofit, higher ed, and it really was an effort to define what are those higher level skills, what you might almost call the soft skills, but they're not soft at all, that students really need to succeed in this 21st century paradigm. And it really does go to the heart of what you're thinking about. You know, one of the things, if you have that the report, the high school report, one chart that we put in this that maybe helps try and sum it all up. There's a graph on page 7
Kevin was going to ask you to cover that. So would you please do that, in not in detail, but please do take some time to talk
about
that.
Sure, what I was going to say was, you'll see on the footnote for the 21st Century Skills Partnership is on that, that second column. This was an effort to come up with a simple way, and I found this chart to be useful in meetings with teachers and others. It, of course, it oversimplifies things, but it's really important to say, one of the things that the Task Force of High School Principals felt about the governor's statement that high schools were obsolete, and in that speech, which they all actually read, there was no mention of the percentage of our kids for whom our high schools work superbly well. And I was in D.C. last week, and someone from the Gates Foundation actually said for 30% of our kids in the U.S., they get a better education than anyone in the world. And how you put an exact percentage on that, you don't know. If high schools were obsolete for all kids, and if they were not focused on post-secondary success for all kids, they'd be pretty easy to change. The hard reality is they work very well for some kids. And so a lot of us know, as soon as you begin to talk about getting students who, for instance, are less familiar with advanced coursework into those classes, you face the challenge of the perception of students and families who live in those classes. And that's just a tension we have to work through. So this chart is an effort to say the transition is really not from bad to good. It's from high schools that are focused on preparing some students for post-secondary and academic outcome to high schools that are focused on it for all students. So the first piece was expectations. The second was the knowledge and skills. And you'll see there, to your point, we talked about it really is a paradigm shift from all students are expected to achieve proficiency on state standards. That's really where we are with, that's the minimum for some kids. So all students go beyond the basics to master 21st century skills of critical thinking, creativity, and collaboration. Again, the things that some of our students are getting in spades, and setting that as an objective for all kids. And you can see we move there through rigor, relevance, and relationships to partnerships, the fact that high schools really can't be asked to do this on their own, not least because, as the representative suggested, as an English teacher, you can't possibly be expected to know what college-level writing is on all of the various institutional campuses. Students need a plan. Students have got to have a pathway forward. We've got to begin to look at assessments that don't just measure the summative data at the end, but actually provide teachers and the students themselves with indicators early on of readiness that they can address. The old statement about how you don't fatten the cow by weighing it. We have to actually have tests that help teachers and students address readiness. The counseling and guidance piece, of course, has been one in which we really have got to make sure that we not only through counselors, though they're at the core of this work, put in place the supports to help kids work those plans. And then a final point really is one that it would be important not to leave this discussion without highlighting. One of the things that we're seeing, and I've seen it at the university more than when I was working on this stuff in St. Paul, we've got a lot of kids who are really on the path to readiness, college readiness, and then they just basically take their senior year off. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I knew this happened, but it's really been stunning. One of the things that, and math is, again, a great example, though not the only one. You have students who take 3 years of pretty rigorous math, and they may hit pre-calc as juniors. And then they don't take mathematics their senior year, and then they show up and they're expected to do college algebra, and they've had more than a full calendar year away from math. Now, this is one reason at the university that we're considering adding 4 years of math as a requirement for all entering students. It's now a requirement for students in the Institute of Technology, the Carlson School of Business, and the College of Biological Sciences, but not for the College of Liberal Arts or Education and Human Development and some other school. Part of the reason, though, we haven't just pushed the button and done that is it's not just any math. You want to make sure students are taking rigorous math. And that everything here comes with a cost. When I first got there and the provost mentioned that they were interested in doing that, I said, well, get ready for some angry band parents, because we've got a lot of kids who are waiting for that senior year to take Mrs. Johnson's X class. And now you're going to bump it out as a, you know, requirement. And yet we know that basically coasting your senior year, especially for our students who are academically fragile, if they take, frankly, they can't even take the summer after their senior year off. I mean, there's some interesting data nationally that says that students of color going into four-year undergraduate programs do significantly better if they participate in what's often called a bridge experience, where they not only continue their rigor fully in high school during senior year, but they go right into an academic preparation program the summer after that feeds into their undergraduate experience. So it's the basic point is this is all about academic momentum. It's about the kid owning their journey and continuing to build upon that progress. So that chart is, there's a lot of people who disagree with certain pieces and puzzles of it, but it's a nice device to have this discussion about high schools.
And I did want to comment on one other thing that you talked about at the beginning of your presentation when you talked about Mayor Rybak making that profound statement to those students, and you said that he said, if you want to be a millionaire, go to the career center. And just that statement in and of itself is really paradoxical. How many rooms are the career center in a
building? Right. It's a great point.
One. How many people staff that? One. How many kids are required to go there in this whole experience? I don't know about you people, but career education is an option in my children's high school to take that exploratory type class, and I couldn't get my kids to take it if I paid them. And what you're saying is $20.
Yeah.
And there is some stigma around that place and that class. And my one son said, that's the class that they encourage those who can't make it in some other classes to take.
You know, that's a fascinating kind of spin on the mayor's talking point, because that initiative, as some of you probably know, and I think it's very promising, it's the right thing to be doing, actually, in terms of school district staff in there, it's zero. It's all funded by the business community, and the Wallen Foundation has been greatly behind it, and of course, they're just heroic, and $10 million and counting in scholarships to Minneapolis kids and all. One of the reasons they've done that is because they were so frustrated with either the inability or the fact that schools didn't have a way to staff that work. So they're basically paying for these seven centers in every Minneapolis high school. One of the great challenges they face is exactly what you said. If this is just a separate room with nice computers and a good staff person paid by the business community, and it's not integrated into the regular life of students in that high school. So I really like your notion that if that's the only $1 million room, it's not going to work, because every classroom has to be the $1 million.
In there.
Yeah, every classroom in a Minneapolis high school or any high school has to be the $1 million room. So that's an interesting. I'm not going to stand up the next time. I'm not that I follow the mayor around, but I've been there a couple times. I'm not going to stand up and stop his thunder, but you know, it's a really good school reform point.
Yeah.
I think.
The other thing that I would just like you to speak to is have you seen any good models in high schools? And I think actually St. Paul embarked on one at one point that motivate the non-motivated.
You know, there's a great example. In fact, I don't know that it makes sense or technology. I actually have a 60-minute clip of it. There's one program that I like to highlight, and I actually use that clip. It's called AVID. Advancement via Individual Determination. And if you Google it, it's AVID online. Started by a high school teacher in San Diego 25 years ago. And it's an elective class, and we brought it into St. Paul. It's now spread in Minneapolis, and it's in Richfield, and some other schools are taking it. It's now got a junior high middle school component. And this 60 Minutes clip really is, it's wonderful because it puts a face on these kids from what they call the academic middle. Mm-hmm. The students who are, they're not, it's not beyond them, but they would no way have been taking advanced placement in an IB. And what AVID does is there's an AVID curriculum and an AVID coach who's a teacher who really feels this work passionately. And the AVID curriculum is really about everything from time management to aspirations to taking Cornell notes to how you sit and interact in the classroom. But then concurrent to the AVID curriculum, which is really about how you manage life, which so many of those students you're talking about just don't have either the skills or the motivation or whatever to do, there's also tutorial support in the more rigorous courses that they take concurrent with the AVID class. So they have college students and others who come in who tutor the kids in the advanced class that they wouldn't have otherwise been in. And it's a regular class, it has to be in the curriculum, and it's really good stuff, and it's been external research nationally has really validated it as a powerful example. That's an intervention for some kids within a school that I would highlight, and that's great. And then the reality is there also are schools that have done this in an exciting way, more comprehensively. There are High Tech High in San Diego has done it in exciting ways. The Central Park East in the 90s did it in some really interesting ways.
And I think that we have maybe some beginning examples of high schools that are comprehensively focused on this mission in Minnesota. I mean, certainly if you go to the Perpich Center for the Arts, they talk in these terms, in ways that talk a lot about higher learning. It often doesn't necessarily culminate post-secondary education, but it's very future-focused in some deep ways. And the work we did in St. Paul, we very much saw that the reality was when we put in place a six-year plan that asked kids to chart a course through 4 years of high school and 2 years beyond, students wanted to do that. They wanted to be thinking ahead. The challenge for us was finding the grading advisory structures and the curriculum and the opportunities to help them do that. And that's one of the things that we hope to help high schools do from this vantage point at the university, because as we've said about a dozen times here tonight, they can't do that on their own.
Briefly, please, what the acronym stands for, Addis.
Advancement via individual determination.
We have a tradition here, and that is we always end with Representative Benson.
We are going to end.
Representative.
Well, just a little comment and a question. Comment is very short. The university's work with the Principals Academy, I think, is really right on. In the previous century, when maybe only one of the member of the faculty had a degree, that principal teacher was critical. I do think leadership in schools is an absolute critical factor in the success of those that we see unsuccessful. And I was kind of chafed under principals who were not principal academics, principal teachers. They were good at organizing the academic athletic schedules and getting the buses and seeing the lights turned on and all those kinds of things, but few, if any of them, I ever came in contact with someone I thought was competent in the academic subjects, or at least to make determinations on curriculum. And that hasn't changed, so I'm hoping that this academy will move them in that direction, so that this positive development. Commissioner, I'm thinking about Zika, and an off comment, because she was dealing with other issues at the time, she also brought up the idea that it's really time to think seriously about taking some things off the list. And you see that she had it here in the presentation. There wasn't time for me to ask the question of the commissioner at that time, but I had wanted very much to ask her, well, commissioner, what things are you suggesting we take off the list? So I'd like to ask you that question.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a question that over 6 years of saying this in St. Paul, I haven't found a good answer yet to, but I'm continually trying to. The short answer would be, but it's a huge answer, the academic low roads. Right now, we really are spending a lot of, I mean, anybody who's had to build a high school schedule knows that it is just bewildering mathematics. And the reality is we tie up a tremendous number of our resources in our high schools. And I know because I used to teach in that road at one point. In pathways that are explicitly designed not to be rigorous and not to have certain kids in those classes. Those are not there just for sort of pernicious evil reasons. They're there because for years high schools thought that was their job to have that track. We needed to have a skills track. That was literally what it was called in Bloomington when I was teaching, and it wasn't special ed. There were a lot of special ed kids who end up in there, but it was there. So the part of the macro point I would suggest is there is one answer is that pathways that really don't take kids to higher level standards. And now how do you determine that? You can't determine that unless you have an agreement on the fact that college or post-secondary readiness is the goal for the school and you define that. And then you can have a difficult but clear decision about does this course take us to that goal or does it not. Those are the big pathways that are there. The challenge, though, beyond that, too, is, and this is a really hard issue, that I don't think anybody, definitely from the state or the university level, can solve, and I think maybe not even from the district. This really is a school-by-school discussion. We have got a lot of our resources in high schools and courses that are there because individual teachers are passionate about or really comfortable teaching X.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I understand it. Often those are just, like, gems for those students. But the hard reality is, if our goal is making sure student experiences lead up to a coherent summative achievement, that this kid actually, the knowledge and skills have built up over time and they result in students who are truly well prepared, then one of the things we have to take off is an allowing ourselves as educators to teach what we want the way we want, and we got to make tough decisions about what gets kids on the path to readiness. So those are two broad answers to how you have that discussion, and if you bring Steve Massey from Forest Lake, or I could give you other examples of school leaders that are trying to have that discussion in a thoughtful, engaged way from the perspective of, as you say, instructional leadership, not just cutting the budgets, that's one piece of it. There are other things that I think answer the question that we need to think about operationally. I mean, the reality of it is, everything from transportation to extracurriculars to textbook adoptions, in this vision, I would say, need to be subjected to the question, does this add up to post-secondary readiness in the high school? And if we have that tough discussion about does it take us to that goal, we never were able to have that discussion before if we didn't have a common goal about what our high school's purpose is for. So we could legitimate everything. And we didn't do it, once again, out of bad intentions. We did it because any goal was okay, because we all were there. So getting clear about the goal of high school potentially could give us a chance to define this what do we take off list. But as I said, part of the reason I think I may stumble in this answer, and I still don't think I did much better than I've done, this really is an answer for school communities, including the parent communities that are involved in them, to grapple with themselves. I don't think that there's a great likelihood of success for those of us who don't live and breathe in these schools to determine what to take off. We can help them realize their mission, their expectations, measure it, give them best practices to achieve it, and then they need to make those tough decisions about what they do and don't do to get to it.
I feel that society has changed dramatically since the turn of the previous century. And to me, our society in desperation to know what to do about this integration of the nuclear family and all those kinds of issues has turned in desperation to the public schools somehow as a stopgap. And I agree with all the potential suggestions you're coming up with here, but that is the fundamental problem of our society, I think. And I can't see how people want to suggest schools no longer carry on some of those functions.
Yeah.
Mr. Patel? Yes. I think we're going to have further discussions in the future, and so I don't think we need to answer this tonight, but I would, in my visits to the high school, what I did notice is that our standards are driving a lot of them trying to cover a lot of things in a very short period of time. And so we are going to talk about standards, and it's the math standards that are being rewritten right now, correct?
It's largely done. It'll be in rulemaking. So
yes.
Yeah.
And so
the proposal is done.
Have you been a part of that process?
I haven't been a direct part of it, but I've definitely followed it. Cindy Christ, who's here from State College and Universities, and a number of us have been involved to varying degrees, and then Larry Gray, who's our chair of the math department at the U, co-chaired the revision process. I will tell you, it's actually a fascinating discussion I urge you to get into. It was more than a tweaking. It was a very significant rewrite, especially in the early grades. And I think it really had this eye toward college readiness being a part of it. I think they also admirably grappled with questions about being broad and encyclopedic in what you expect kids to know, and going deep in core conceptual knowledge in mathematics. And so my sense from the outside looking in, and I've read the final versions, both of what the department has put together and what the P16 working group on that effort put together, I think from the work I did in St. Paul, it is a significant improvement if our goal is getting kids ready for higher level thinking in mathematics by the middle grades.
Well, I think that's a good note to adjourn on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This meeting is adjourned.